Hello, Derek.
I am here.
Hey, welcome to the Edge broadcast there, Derek.
Honor to be here, brother. Just asking people to pray for me as I try to summarize what Sharon knows about this coronavirus outbreak. She's really, really the expert. I've just been trying to learn as much as I can by listening to her for the last month.
Well, there's been a lot going on with that, Derek, and the news is full of that information. You know, in fact, that seems to be the topic now that Trump's been acquitted. I mean, that was a full-scale news story for months, and now that's over, and this, all of a sudden, this coronavirus comes on the scene, and there are a lot of questions about that, Derek, that we can go over on that, and we'll talk about that, say, in the first hour, and then we'll talk about your guys' book of veneration in the second hour.
That sounds like a plan.
Well, the coronavirus, let me just, I've got some input here. We're going to wrap back and forth, Derek, because, of course, now I think the technical name of that is, what is it, COVID-19?
COVID-19, coronavirus infection or infectious disease 19, I think is what the official anagram stands for, or acronym stands for, rather. I think the World Health Organization has been trying real hard not to tie it to a specific location. You know, they don't want to call it the Spanish flu like 100 years ago. They don't want to call this the Chinese flu, the Hong Kong flu. You might remember, you're old enough to remember.
Yeah.
So they've been trying to not stigmatize a particular place with the name of this thing. And, you know, that even with that, we're getting reports or seeing news stories on people of Asian descent or Asian appearance who are being discriminated against or targeted. New York Post reporting New York cab drivers avoiding Chinatown. Chinese restaurants are having a rough time doing business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can kind of understand where people are coming from. But look, just because somebody is Chinese does not mean that they've got this disease.
No.
Now, on the other hand, you want to be careful when it comes to people traveling from that part of China, because this disease is very infectious.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is something that the World Health Organization and the Chinese government have been very slow about getting out in front of and letting people know about it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to be absolutely honest here. I was at a Starbucks with Susan the other day, and a Chinese person walked in, and I noticed myself that I didn't go to instant judgment, but I had like a shock, an abbreviated surprise, probably because my head is full of China, Wuhan. I mean, just on and on and on. You know, virus, China. So, you know, and I saw a Chinese person, and it's like I was sort of surprised. And I asked myself, now why did I react that way? You know, I don't want to react that way. I mean, I didn't say, hey, get out of here like that. But it was, I just noticed that I did have, and it's really maybe a self-preservation thing. But let me ask you something. You talk about COVID-19, Derek. I'm just wondering, what about COVID-1 through 18? Man, are those out there too?
No, it's a coronavirus infectious disease 2019. It's kind of the abbreviation there. So, I think that's all that means. Why did this break out in China? China's got a couple of factors that probably enter into this. They've got a bat population that's got a wide range, in particular a horseshoe bat, which is a known reservoir of this particular strain of disease. People by now probably know, but I'll repeat this just in case, is that the title of the virus specifically is not coronavirus. The coronavirus is a family of viruses that includes SARS, which was a disease that broke out back in 2002 in China, killed about 800 people. But the coronavirus family also includes the common cold. So this is something that many of us have been exposed to, at least in terms of the family of viruses, just that there's something particularly infectious about this particular strain. And just to give you an idea now, based on new research from a Swedish team, on average, the seasonal flu, the stuff that we get those messages from mainstream media about every year, and the commercials from healthcare workers saying, you know, you got to get your flu shot, got to get your flu shot, got to get your flu shot. All right. I don't ever get the flu shot. Sharon doesn't ever get the flu shot. And she's got the molecular biology degree. If she was inclined to get it, I would trust her judgment. She's also got some medical training. So I trust her judgment. Neither one of us has, in you know, at least since I've been an adult and able to make my own decisions, have ever gotten a flu shot. So we're not trying to spread any fear here or be fear mongers. The seasonal flus, what they call R naught value.
Right.
That's R with a zero, but R naught is how it's pronounced. On average, has an R naught value of 1.3. That is the mean R naught, meaning each person who gets this flu will, on average, infect slightly over one other person. The Spanish flu, or the great influenza of 1918-1919, the mean R-naught value was 2, which means each person who got it infected two other people. Now, bear in mind, the Spanish flu killed probably 50 to 100 million people. So, and this was in a world with four times fewer people than we have today, and people who couldn't fly from country to country on intercontinental airlines. Right now, this Swedish team's new research, which was just published yesterday or today, the news article I saw on this was just released today. They're estimating the mean R naught of this COVID-19 virus at 3.28. In other words, half again more transmissible than the Spanish flu of 100 years ago. Mm. Whereas the World Health Organization, if anything, has been underplaying this because they've been estimating an R naught of about 1.4. So we're not trying to fearmonger here. We're just trying to give you the best information that we can. And it does appear that this is the real deal. So people who are saying, this is just to sell more shots or whatever. Now, I'm sorry, you really need to wake up because that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. I was watching a video from China. It was translated, and it was a guy's face was hidden, and he is the head of a funeral home there, and he said that he was getting on the average of 130 dead people a day, and they can't hardly move them fast enough. And he said that the Chinese government only allows him to report 6. And he said of all the, and this is in Wuhan, and he said of all the other funeral homes have the same way. They've been vastly overrun by request for, and I assume they're cremating. But the numbers are, I don't think that we're getting the right numbers, Derek. What do you think?
No, we agree with that. And this is something that Sharon's been watching very closely. In fact, just before the broadcast, she's gone off to bed dealing with the migraine, but she did tweet several screen caps from that webpage that's been put up by Johns Hopkins University, drawing information from the World Health Organization, the CDC, and other sources, including the Chinese government. But because China is kind of a closed shop when it comes to information. I mean, things leak out like what you described, other things that have made it to the internet. There have been a couple of citizen journalists who were posting a lot of stuff that the government really didn't want out there. And both of them haven't been heard from in several days now. I think they've one of the Hong Kong broadcasters, RTHK, said that the second fellow was had just tweeted out a 12-second video, something to the effect of return power to the people, something like that. And that was just before police and firemen knocked down the door of his apartment to take him away. I agree. I don't think we're getting the right, accurate information from China. And that's where most of the cases are. But Sharon tweeted 3 weeks ago, the official number of confirmed cases was 11,374. 2 weeks ago, that had only grown to about 14,013. But then between 2 weeks ago and last week, that jumped from 14,013 to 37,016 or 162, which is about 2.5 times increase. And then from last week to this week, we've gone 37,000 and changed to almost 70,000. So it's almost doubled in the last week after more than doubling the week before that. So the official numbers are troubling enough without, whatever the actual numbers are. And there are some voices now who are in positions to know what these numbers should look like if the numbers are being accurately reported, saying, yeah, this looks way low. What's been encouraging the last couple of days, again, and this depends on whether these numbers are accurate or not, is that the last couple of days, the number of confirmed cases seems to have dropped off. I pray that that's accurate, but we can't know for sure because we don't really get a clear look into what's happening inside China. The Chinese government really locks down a lot of information before it escapes the country there. Mm-hmm. What we haven't seen until just yesterday were any cases in Africa. And this is something that healthcare workers, healthcare professionals around the world are concerned about, because the infrastructure in Africa, if anything, is much worse than it is in China. It's and there is one international airport or airline that has not shut down or even slowed down its number of daily flights back and forth to China. That is Ethiopian Airlines. Wow. The other six major airlines operating out of Africa with international flights to China, including South African Air and Kenya Air, they have all stopped or suspended flights to China. But Ethiopia is still running thousands of Chinese back and forth to its international airport. And then from there, many of these are Chinese businessmen who have interests elsewhere in China, in Africa. They're flying to other parts of Africa. Well, yesterday, Egypt confirmed its first case. So healthcare professionals in Africa are saying, quite honestly, we're not prepared for this. So if we thought the West African Ebola outbreak 5 years ago, which killed over 11,000 people, was bad, just wait until this starts to spread. Now, this is not nearly as deadly as Ebola, which is a case fatality rate of anywhere from 30-50%, depending on the strain. This, depending on who you ask, is running between 2.5% and 10%, but it's more transmissible. So, and the other thing is that this, or well, there's some evidence suggesting that this may be more transmissible, or transmissible in ways that we've not been told. It was believed that this particular coronavirus would only spread through droplets in the air, like when somebody sneezes, you know, with a common cold.
Yeah.
There are a couple of cases in Hong Kong that appear now to be connected to a leaky vent stack in the plumbing of an apartment building. Somebody did a makeshift repair in their apartment, and they breached the vent. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, and they have found that people with this coronavirus are shedding it through their solid waste, through feces.
Yeah.
So if it's going up the vent stack, that means it's airborne, which means it's that's going to be more difficult to contain than was previously thought. So
now I've discovered something, and I think I'm watching you and Sharon talk about it. In China, don't they have something called a squat potty? Is that what it is?
Well, it depends on where you go, apparently. I've never been to China, so all I can tell you is what I've read. But I do know when you go to some travel websites that have suggestions for people traveling overseas, mm-hmm. countries, places they've never been before, there are websites out there that will travel sites that have pages that will instruct you on the proper use of a squatty potty.
Right.
It is basically, it's like a pot. The pot is flush with the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And so you basically have to squat because you don't sit down on it.
Yeah.
And that means you've got to bring your own paper, and you've got to have some hand sanitizer, and you got to be prepared for it to splash, you know. I've also received some email from people who say, look, I've lived in China for 10 years or worked in China mm-hmm. for a number of years, and I've never seen a squatty potty. So, mm-hmm. okay, I don't know. I don't know.
I had to know. Okay, so I looked it up. They are there. And basically, there are instructions, and they're written in Chinese and in English. But basically, for those that are flush to the floor, the instructions are: you take your clothes off from the bottom half and take your shoes off. So you're standing right on the floor, right where people have, let's just say, relieved themselves. And so it's obviously a place for transmittal. I don't know if their hygiene practices are as good as the United States, but as you said, some of that may have transmitted through pipes, indicating it may be airborne.
Right, right. And again, getting back to Africa, the reason I mentioned this is because if it's airborne, I've read some accounts from people who are working in ministries in Africa, people with the Peace Corps, who describe certain rural areas in Africa as, fecalized environments. Because indoor plumbing is not a thing. So if this China, which is trying to buy its way into Africa because of all the raw materials available in Africa, you know, rare earth minerals and, you know, timber and farmland and oil and so forth. If they if they spread this to somewhere in Africa where the infrastructure is not what we think of as, you know, as standard here in the West, it could really take off in certain parts of Africa. And that is a concern, again, for healthcare workers, healthcare professionals working in the third world. It's something that I'm sure keeps people at the World Health Organization and other organizations like, you know, Doctors Without Borders up at night. I see a question in the chat room on the doctor who died after being an early whistleblower on the spread of this disease. My take is this. I don't think he was eliminated by the Chinese government. I think he just contracted the disease because he was sadly exposed to it in trying to treat one of his early patients, one of the earliest victims of this this disease.
By the way, for the, I want to welcome to the chat. We gave the list earlier, but the additions here recently. Mandez, welcome to the program. Ted White, Matthew, Diana P., Vinveka Arnato, and Paul Cici. And Paul, of course, Paul is a previous guest. Welcome back, Paul. Derek, what does it take to change that? Is there a matrix to change the R-naught number?
Basically, it's what the Chinese government is trying to do right now, which is almost draconian measures to keep people indoors. This is the kind of thing that our grandparents, great-grandparents understood when the flu was going around and they didn't have the kind of, well, nutrition or medicine that we have today. They understood that when things were going around, and they had to deal with things like polio that has more or less been wiped out, and smallpox that more or less been that officially has been wiped out, but there are still samples in laboratories. They understood that when things were going around that were life-threatening, you basically shut up the doors and stayed inside. There's a book that we've gotten a copy of now called The Great Influenza, which is an account of the history of the 1918-1919 flu. And really, the people who did the best, the families that did the best, are the ones who shut themselves in behind their doors and had enough food and water, could basically be self-sufficient for a couple of weeks until things burned out. That will probably be what it's going to take in China. And sadly, if it gets over here, and I think we've got about 15 cases confirmed here in the U.S. last time I looked, if I'm remembering correctly. 15 here in the U.S. Most of us are so used to just-in-time deliveries to our grocery stores that we don't have more than a few days of food in our own homes. We're used to either, you know, being able to run out to a fast food place or go down to a mini mart or a grocery store or a super center and just get whatever we want. And if this were to break out in a metropolitan area, you probably would want to avoid doing that if you could. So again, we're not trying to spread any fear here. We're just saying, look, this requires a little common sense. And when you're dealing with a disease that's, well, three times as infectious, or at least 2.5 times more infectious than the typical seasonal flu, you probably want to avoid coming into contact with a lot of people, if you can help it, until this thing is really contained. And that means having enough stuff at home that you can stay home for a week or two without having to run short of stuff.
Well, I've never been accused of using common sense, Derek, but I do know that the coronavirus is actually, and I think like most viruses, it is encased in an envelope. And there's the debate of whether or not how long it can remain in that envelope and remain viable. But should I worry when I go to Walmart, which with everything coming from China, that maybe there's maybe some latent coronavirus laying on some of those things?
A friend of ours in radio back in St. Louis used to call it Wall of China, Mark. No, if it ships over here for sale in a big store like that, it came over on a container, or in a container on one of those big
barges.
One of those big ships across the ocean. And you know, I should know this because I used to deal with overseas transport periodically. But those things will take 30 to 40 days to get here. And the best information I've seen is that the coronavirus will last for maybe 9 hours on a surface. In fact, Sharon just saved some information on that. And okay, well, check that now. It's saying that new study suggests that coronavirus responsible for COVID-19 could survive on inanimate objects for over a week. So, all right. So if you're going to ship something from China and it's coming over air freight, you might, you know, want to wipe it down with Lysol or something when it comes in. But the odds are, I mean, really, viruses are intended to survive within a host. It's got to have some pretty, I think, specific conditions to allow it to survive for up to even that long. Well, most viruses won't survive more than a few hours. And prior to this, which was published by ScienceAlert.com yesterday, I guess on Thursday, maybe a little bit longer.
Well, I hope that the coronavirus isn't the when you read the Lysol spray, it says kills 99.9%. I hope it's not the 0.01% that it won't kill. You know,
well, it's still going to be susceptible to bleach. But here's the thing. As with any seasonal flu outbreak, the best defense that we as humans have is washing our hands frequently, and then get out of the habit of, you know, touching your face, your eyes, or your nose. And so hard to do, but just, you know, lots of soap and water, wash your hands. Mm-hmm. You know, kids, when your parents are telling you to wash your hands, it's not because they're being mean. It's because this is really a time-tested way to avoid getting sick.
Mm. And, you know, I heard like a stat, and I'm probably getting this wrong, but I heard in the last two, he says, on an average day, we touch our face maybe 1,000 times. And so I read that, and then my whiskers, my mustache itched and my ear itched. And I think, wait a minute, here I am with my hands all over my face. Maybe that is true. I don't know. Maybe somebody should count. All right. Hey, Derek, got a question here out of the live chat from Rose. She says, Derek, what can we take to prevent us from getting the coronavirus? What can we take if we have it?
I'm not aware of anything, to be honest with you. Truly not. I think the only thing I can suggest is whatever would help boost your immune system. And there are a number of different things there. This is certainly not my area of expertise, but whatever you can do to boost your immune system is really the best defense. The reason that this virus is so much of a problem right now is because it has a unique protein coat on it. And that, of course, has led to some conspiracy theories about where it came from. But what that means is that we don't have any natural defense against it because we've never seen it before. So there's no natural immunity to it in any of us humans, and there's no vaccine for it. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a story published by WorldNet Daily earlier today that a lab in San Diego claims that they were able to fabricate a vaccine in about 3 hours once they got the genetic code of the virus. It's going to take months to test. I'm dubious. I'd like to see more evidence on that. As with anything else, you know, money is a powerful motivator for a lot of things. I really pray that this is true and that there will be a vaccine that is effective and comes and can be produced within a matter of months. But everything I've heard so far, everything that Sharon has read so far, suggests that a vaccine is probably a year away at best. So nothing we can do at this point other than just limit contact with people who might have been exposed and just, again, use lots of soap and water.
Yeah. It took about 2 seconds after the first announcement in the news of coronavirus in Wuhan. It took about 2 seconds before somebody said, we've traced it down to a combination of Israeli operatives and the Chinese government. You know what I'm saying? I'm thinking, here the hell we go. Okay, now it's always somebody going to say the Israelis is doing something. Why is that, Derek?
Well, there's a lot of anti-Semitism out there, and it gets back to the principalities and powers behind the human actors. They, without rabbit trailing down that way, there have been people trying to destroy the Jews ever since they left Mount Sinai or headed for Mount Sinai. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think there's something to do with it. Now, let me just throw this out there, though. There is some evidence, circumstantial evidence, to suggest that this may have been an experiment that escaped the laboratory. And here are the pieces. And credit to ZeroHedge.com, which put this together. I look at them a lot for news every day. They started out as a financial website, but now they cover just a lot of news that mainstream sites don't want to touch. They haven't been completely right on this. They were publishing some stuff from a site called Great Game India, and I think Great Game India was just to be honest with you, putting out clickbait. Mm-hmm. There was a case last year, last March, that this turned into a scandal in Canada. And of course, we here in the U.S., we were too busy, you know, arguing about Donald Trump to really pay attention. But in March of last year, live samples of a couple of deadly viruses were sent from Canada's only BSL-4 laboratory in Winnipeg. It's not the only one in Winnipeg. It's the lab in Winnipeg is the only BSL-4 lab in Canada. And BSL-4 is the highest level of biosecurity containment. You need that's the kind of laboratory that's authorized to work with stuff like Marburg and Ebola and Nipah and this particular coronavirus. Full hazmat suits, vacuum or negative pressure inside the chambers and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So samples of Ebola and Nipah, which is another deadly pathogen with a, when it breaks out, a case fatality rate of like 1/3, which is Ebola level deadly, were sent back to Beijing from Winnipeg on a commercial Air Canada flight. So, you know, you got a bunch of passengers on this Air Canada flight, and then somewhere in the baggage hold was a container with these live virus samples of these deadly pathogens. Mm. So the Royal Canadian Mounted Police investigated, and they found by July that it had come from this lab in Winnipeg. They identified the two scientists involved, the husband and wife, and they were walked out of the building and had their security clearances revoked. Now, the woman was really the center of this. She's a virologist. She had developed a treatment for Ebola called ZMAP, which has proven fairly effective. So she's done some good work out there. But why did she send these back to Beijing? And then, you know, connecting more dots, in October, Canadian press reported that she had been back to China about five times in 2017 and 2018 to train scientists at China's brand new and only BSL-4 laboratory, which just happens to be in Wuhan. Round zero for this outbreak. Now, Great Game India was connecting those dots and saying, aha, we found the smoking gun. Not necessarily. But let me add this. Having said that, a retired lieutenant colonel in the Israeli military intelligence, Danny Shoham, and that's S-H-O-H-A-M, if anybody wants to look this up, published a paper within the last 2 weeks in which he said, and he's got a doctorate in molecular biology or microbiology, mm-hmm. and his emphasis, his area of expertise when he worked for Israeli intelligence was tracking bioweapons development around the world. And he said that they're pretty well convinced that China is working on a bioweapons program. Well, okay, they're doing it in Russia and we're doing it here in the U.S. too. So it would be a surprise if China wasn't working mm-hmm. on some sort of biological weapons. But the lab in Wuhan, the Wuhan Virology Institute, is one of the places where experts elsewhere in the world are convinced that China would be working on a bioweapons program. Mm. Now, does this mean this is an escape bioweapon? No, it's circumstantial evidence. We're just putting dots on the paper here to see what looks right when they connect. Mm-hmm. Now, Zero Hedge reported just a couple of days ago is this. Back in 2015, well, first of all, they mentioned that the Chinese military has taken over the response to the virus. A major general by the name of Chen Wei, who is considered Chinese chief biochemical weapon defense expert, is now in charge of China's response to containing the outbreak. Still doesn't mean this is an escape bioweapon, but it does suggest that the Chinese government understands that this is really nasty, and they need somebody who understands the way a bioweapon might work to try to get a cordon around this this outbreak. Now, they mentioned the Zero Hedge article goes on to report and cited other research that back in 2015, a couple of Chinese researchers working at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill as members of a, 15-member team. They published a paper back in 2015 that described the creation of a new virus that this team created by combining, and by the way, the other researchers on this team at UNC were American researchers, so we can't blame this entirely on China. They created a new virus by combining a coronavirus that they found that is found in Chinese horseshoe bats. That's that species I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And another virus that creates a human-like severe acute respiratory syndrome response or SARS, in mice. And why did they use mice? Because mice have a similar similar ACE2 receptors, which is what the coronavirus binds to, apparently. The ACE2 receptors in mice are very, very similar to the ACE2 receptors in humans. Okay? Mm-hmm. So what they did was they created a Frankenvirus, a hybrid virus, a chimeric virus. And I'm going to quote from the paper's summary now, the abstract. Evaluation of available SARS-based immune therapeutic and prophylactic modalities revealed poor efficacy. Both monoclonal antibody and vaccine approaches failed to neutralize and protect from the coronaviruses utilizing the novel spike protein. In other words, to put this into plain English, they created a virus and couldn't figure out how to stop it from spreading.
Ooh.
Monoclonal antibodies and vaccine approaches were ineffective. Now, these two Chinese researchers, and I'm going to mangle their names, Zhengli Shi and Xingyi Ge, that's my best guess, best guess on both of those, they have since left the University of North Carolina and are now working at, guess where, the Wuhan Virology Institute.
Mm-hmm.
So, circumstantial evidence, but it would appear that the most likely explanation for the origin of this COVID-19 virus is that researchers working on a potential cure for a new type of coronavirus didn't follow proper sanitation protocols and it got out of the lab. That's where the evidence suggests that's our best guess as to how this whole thing started.
Yeah. Well, this show's never been one to go down any kind of ridiculous conspiracy theory at all. I have no line on that, Derek, because I don't have a reputation to maintain. So that gives me a whole lot of freedom, by the way, my friend, that others simply don't have. So let's go ahead and go down one of those. In 1993, it appears the Simpsons had a show on the coronavirus. I've got a picture. I don't know if you're watching the video, but it's a screenshot of that Simpsons episode 93. But that may be the case, or that being the case, the Simpsons also sort of predicted or pre-showed the 9/11. It showed Trump coming down the escalator to be the president years before he even said he was going to do it. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that seem to have been released through the Simpsons. So in this conspiracy theory, what do you think?
Well, I think when you're when you've been around as long as the Simpsons have and have to come up with new content every week, you know, however many episodes they produce per year, 26 new episodes per season for however long they've been on, you're eventually going to do something that at some point in the future may appear to be prophetic. China's been dealing with coronavirus outbreaks for a long time. SARS, MERS, which was a Middle Eastern, similar virus, but Middle Eastern and a different reservoir, came from camels instead of bats or pangolins or civets. So, you know, it's been around a long time. I don't know. Maybe the principalities and powers behind the scenes are having a joke at our expense. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you what, on a more serious note, I've come to the conclusion by the way, this broadcast is like the 989th broadcast interview I've done through the years. But I come to the conclusion, and tell me if you have any feeling on this, that is somewhere in the realms of evil, and we're going to be getting into your book Veneration here just shortly, and we'll be talking about these ancient realms and demonic kings, but is there something out there that says the demonic world must announce or get approval from humans before they exact some sort of vengeance or release something upon humans?
You know, that's not something I've researched.
I don't see anything in the
texts that I've been studying, but studying secret societies and what they teach is not something I've done a whole lot of. So there are others out there who could answer that question better than I can.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get to another question here. Somebody else said conspiracy time. Is it possible the virus could be a designer virus to open the door to an upcoming real pandemic virus?
Boy, I don't know how much more you would need to open the door than this one.
It seems like it's open, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, because there have been some who are, again, people in a position to know, like the chair of the public health department at Hong Kong University just said earlier this week that this could affect up to 60% of the world's population as it is. So you're already talking about this thing potentially spreading to as many as 5 billion people. I don't know how much more deadly you'd want to make something like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and continuing down the conspiracy rabbit hole, one of my favorite places to be, I'd like to hang out there, have me a latte, whatever. Of course, we have the Georgia Guidestones. For those conspiracy theorists that 20 years ago said 500,000 Chinese were on the southern border, maybe they mistook that. Instead of killing us like a Red Dawn situation, they're going to release a virus tailor-made to get the American DNA, so to speak, target that, and just walk in after all the people have passed away. What do you think about that?
Well, it's yeah, I agree that the those people behind the Georgia Guidestones have this desire to see us reduce the world's population down to what they consider a manageable level. But I think they've already done that just through propaganda. Mm-hmm. We're told that the Earth is overpopulated. We need to stop having children because of climate change, and we're going to overheat the planet. But if you look at the actual numbers from people who make a living of studying demographics, we're already going to peak. The world's population is going to peak at about the middle of this century. And there are a couple fellows in Canada who wrote a book on this about a year ago that really didn't get much traction in the mainstream media because it doesn't fit the narrative. Mm-hmm. But they're concerned that when the world population begins to decline, that it may never stop because we've got a population that's getting older. Most of the northern hemisphere is already not having enough children to just maintain a population. As we age, we get to a point where you can't have children anymore, whether you want them or not. So there are only a few places on the planet where the people are having enough children to maintain or increase the population. But boy, you get north of the northern hemisphere, Asia in particular, is already beginning to see a decline. We're seeing the demographic death of Japan, of Hong Kong, Singapore. China is now in this situation where they realize, hey, wait a minute, our population is going to peak and begin to decline. And what happens if we get all these old people and we don't have enough young? We're going to be in the same boat here in the United States within the next 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think they've already convinced us to commit demographic suicide without having to release a killer virus.
Mm-hmm. Derek, one of the things I like about you having you on the show, man, I never can trick you into going with any of my ridiculous conspiracy theories. you just keep coming back. But hey, you don't hang up on me, man, so it's a lot of fun for me. But I try to sneak.
Love you, brother.
But they're not going to stop me from trying, man. I'm going to sneak one in here, and you're going to accidentally agree with me. So, all right. Now the question. Kevin says, Derek, it's evident how careful and Bible astute you were in the book Veneration, Satan's Battle Plan for Armageddon. Do you feel pushed by Yahshua to write it?
Well, I can't come up with any better explanation than that, Kevin. That this is not something I saw myself doing, 10 years ago. So, and besides, who would pick, an old top 40 radio disc jockey to be writing books of theology anyway? Mm-hmm. So God's got a sense of humor. But as we started digging into some of the weird stuff, we get into the weird parts of the Bible and start trying to, pull on those threads. It's like, okay, what is there a grain of truth behind this? What's the history behind these mighty men who were of old, the giants, the Nephilim of Genesis chapter 6? And when we started digging into it for the Last Clash of the Titans and the previous book, The Great Inception, Sharon and I began to realize, because she takes a lot of this research and incorporates it into her fiction series, The Red Wing Saga, mm-hmm. which has now got 6 novels, and she's working on novel number 7 right now. We began to realize how important this cult of the dead were. Let me back up. Let me make it more plain. The Nephilim inspired a religion. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what we found is that the religion of the Canaanites, the Amorites who surrounded ancient Israel, was basically based on worshiping the Nephilim, the spirits of the Nephilim, and their progenitors, their creators. And that religion became, over the centuries, the religion of the Greeks and the Romans. So the demigods of the Greeks and the Romans, Hercules, Theseus, Perseus, those, by definition, were Nephilim, They knew who the Rephaim were. We can document this with peer-reviewed academic research from secular scholars who don't have a dog in this religious hunt. They're not trying to prove that the Bible is real. But we can show you in Veneration and in the previous books that the prophets and the apostles knew what their neighbors believed. They knew what the Canaanites, the Amorites, and even the Greeks and Romans believed. And there's a reason that God directed them to write about this stuff. So, you know, God bless the researchers like Steve Quayle and L.A. Marzulli and Tom Horn, who expend time and money and their risk their reputation going out looking for the physical evidence of the giants, because that would be fantastic to find this. Sharon and I decided to go a different direction and say, you know what? We can document that these giants were worshipped by the pagans of the ancient world, and that it's reflected in the Bible. You see it in Isaiah 14, Isaiah 26, Ezekiel 32, Ezekiel 38 and 39. We're even seeing it in the book of Revelation. You know, Job, in Job chapter 26, the dead quake under the waters. No, the Rephaim quake under the waters. The English translations have covered up the references to these spirits of the ancient giants, the Nephilim, by translating Rephaim as the dead or the shades or the departed. But that's because, in part, what we know now about the Rephaim has only been discovered within the last 50 years or so, as texts from these ancient Amorite kingdoms have been translated. So the great theologians of the 19th century, even the 20th century, the first half of the 20th century, didn't even have access to the texts that we have now. And as we're peeling this back and realizing, hey, wait a minute, this stuff is all key to understanding the spiritual war that we're all a part of. This whole battle from Genesis to Revelation is about when God cursed the serpent, the Nakash, in the garden, and prophesied a war between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. This was all about whose spiritual and physical, but mainly spiritual descendants would be standing at the last trump when, as Paul writes, we shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. And those of us who have accepted Jesus Christ will be raised incorruptible. I think we see repudiation or a condemnation of the spirits of the children of the Watchers, the Nephilim spirits called Rephaim in the Bible, in places in, like I said, Isaiah 26, Ezekiel 39 in particular, where they're condemned to death. We're going to be raised, and they are still going to be dead.
Derek, when I first saw the cover of your book, and I've got it right here, so let me just hold this thing up right here for the folks to take a look at it. When I first saw that king, I mean, it looks like a king to me. It reminded me of the scene in Lord of the Rings where all the sort of dead kings had come to the rescue of the little midget with the big feet. And is that these type of people are they out there? Are they moving around on the earth? Are they coming back? Or where are they at right now?
Well, we dig into what the Hebrew prophets understood and the early church understood about these spiritual beings. It was believed and understood by the early church, by the apostles, by the early church fathers that the Rephaim, these spirits, were demons. And that their origin was the spirits of the Nephilim who were destroyed in the flood. And we show from the writings of the early church fathers like Irenaeus and Origen and Justin Martyr that that was pretty much the default belief of the early church. It wasn't until the time of Augustine and Julius Africanus, I believe, were the two in the 4th and early 5th centuries who began to change the direction of church theology by arguing against that belief and claiming that the giants of Genesis 6 were actually the sons of the sons of Seth who married the daughters of Cain, and from them came these giants. But that was not the belief of the early church. The book of Enoch makes it very clear in 1st Enoch 9, and there's also some verses in Jubilees in the Apocrypha that discusses these. But again, when you go back and read the underlying Hebrew behind our English translations, and when you read the Septuagint, interestingly enough, the Septuagint translation, which is a translation done by Jewish scholars about 200 to 250 years before the birth of Jesus, you find references to the giants and the Titans, who were the old gods of the Greeks, who were banished to Tartarus by Zeus and the Olympians, it was clear that the Jews in the centuries before the birth of Jesus understood that there was a connection between the pagan small g gods and these fallen angels who'd rebelled against Yahweh, and that the giants, the demons that they contended with, were the spirits of the giants. So, yes, they according to Enoch, were condemned to wander the earth until the judgment, plaguing humanity, basically tormenting humanity until the judgment. So, yeah, they're still with us today. And when you think about it, that means that when Jesus was casting out demons left, right, and center across the land of Israel, when the apostles went out and were casting out demons, they were literally doing battle with the Nephilim.
So is there going to come a point when you and I are going to engage in battle with these same freaks?
Well, if you're ever demonically oppressed or possessed, which as a Christian, you would not be possessed, but you could be oppressed by them. We may already have encountered these spirits in our lives without even realizing it. Yes, I think we
now you realize, hold it, Derek, you realize you might trigger somebody mentioning their ex-wife in the chat.
I take no responsibility for that.
Okay, just saying.
No, we showed in this book and also in Last Clash of the Titans, which was, I think, a different look at the War of Gog and Magog than has been published before. Had an interesting discussion with a well-known prophecy author about this at a conference last year. And I don't want to name names because I love him like a brother, but he was not buying it. But the key verse here is Ezekiel 39, verse 11, where God is telling Ezekiel how the war of Gog and Magog is going to end. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm going to prepare a place for burial in the Valley of the Travelers east of the sea, and it will block the travelers. And the key there, and I give Mike Heiser credit for this, I was listening to his podcast study on Ezekiel 38 and 39, and he pointed out that the word traveler is in the Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible. Now, that's a great reference tool. It's kind of expensive if you want the hard copy, but if you've got Logos Bible software, you can get it at a better price. Travelers was a term used in the ancient world. Going back to the time of, we can document this from pagan text. It goes back to the time of the Judges, so about 1200 BC, where travelers were the spirits of the Rephaim. They were literally called travelers because they traveled or crossed over from the land of the dead to the land of the living. So the Valley of the Travelers east of the sea, well, where is that? Well, the key is that when Moses was told by God to climb Mount Nebo and get his only look at the Holy Land, his only look at the Promised Land across the river there to Jericho, he was said, you know, it was in Book of Deuteronomy, climb this mountain of the, and in the English translation, it's spelled A-B-A-R-I-M, pronounced Avarim. Avarim. That means travelers. Climb this mountain of the travelers. Mount Nebo is the mountain of the travelers. So the east of the sea, well, that's the Dead Sea. So he's pointing to the plains of Moab, which is right across the river, the Jordan River, from Jericho. And within sight of Jerusalem on a clear day, which is ultimately where Armageddon is going to be fought, because this is all about who's going to get control of God's Mount of Assembly, which is Zion, the Temple Mount. Mm-hmm. But that was really intriguing for a lot of reasons, and I won't go into this because I could take up the rest of the program just explaining why I think this is fascinating. And I've done presentations that last 90 minutes just on this topic. But I think that right there, that plains of Moab, that area just across from Jericho, is fascinating. Moses was buried somewhere there. The Valley of the Travelers, the valley of this place where these spirits were known to cross over, it was a demon-haunted place. Archaeological research now, a dig that's going on right now, in fact, as we're recording this tonight, there's a team from Trinity Southwest University working at a dig site that's about 6 miles northwest of Mount Nebo, where you can see it from Mount Nebo. In fact, we pointed it out on our Israel tour, Skywatch TV's Israel tour last year. It's called Tal El Hammam. That is probably, and I say probably with a 90% probability, the site of ancient Sodom.
Ooh.
So Sodom was destroyed. It's not southeast of the Dead Sea like we've traditionally been taught, but northeast of the Dead Sea, within sight of this, of Mount Nebo, which is called this Mountain of the Travelers. Now, why is that significant? Because at the base of Mount Nebo, which is on a hill about 150 feet higher than the plain, there are about 1,500, or there were back in the day. There's about 500 still standing. Dolmens. And dolmens are megalithic funerary monuments. We describe them in this book and also in Last Clash of the Titans. They look like little miniature Stonehenges. You get two standing stones, big slabs of like limestone, and then one tabletop slab across the top. These are funerary monuments that date back to the time of Abraham and before. There were more of them in the Jordan River Valley than anywhere on Earth. I mean, they're found all over the earth. You can find them in, you know, Scotland, Ireland, France, Korea. The nation of Georgia has a bunch of them. But there are more in the Jordan Valley and the Golan Heights than anywhere on earth. And there are more of them at the base of what was Sodom than anywhere in the Jordan Valley. So imagine this. If in fact, this is Sodom, and again, I say I'm 90% sure that it was.
Okay.
Moses and the Israelites get there about 400 years later. And they arrive, they find nothing growing there because, according to the scientists who've been doing this research, apparently whatever exploded in the air that destroyed Sodom kicked up a saltwater tsunami from the Dead Sea.
Whoa.
They've actually done soil samples. They found that the salt content in the soil was too high to let anything grow there for about 700 years. But not only that, it matches the salt content precisely of what's in the Dead Sea. So something, and by the way, this also kind of helps explain the story about Lot's wife turning to a pillar of salt.
Mm-hmm.
Something explodes like Tunguska over the north end of the Dead Sea, destroys the plain. The only thing that's growing there is acacia. And when you read in the book of Deuteronomy, they describe the plains of Moab. They call it the Abel Shittim, which means prairie or meadow of the acacias. The only thing that would grow there because acacias are salt tolerant. Mm. And they look and they see this hill overlooking the plains where the Israelites are camping before they cross the river to attack Jericho. And this ruined city up on the hill with all these destroyed buildings and 1,500 burial monuments, these funerary monuments at the base of the hill. One of the places on the Exodus route was called Ai HaAvarim, which means ruins of the travelers. Mount Nebo, which is right there, is the mountain of the travelers. The travelers are the demon spirits of the Nephilim, according to the pagan texts now. And Ezekiel in Ezekiel 39 says that the army coming to fight against God's people, and I explain why in Last Clash of the Titans, the War of Gog and Magog is equated with the Battle of Armageddon. So this army coming to fight at Jerusalem, at Armageddon, is a demonic army, the travelers. But God says they will be buried in the Valley of the Travelers, east of the sea. And it will block the travelers, which I think gets back to the whole idea of resurrection and who gets resurrected at the last trump.
Mm.
Not them, us.
Mm. I was watching Ancient Aliens, and they did a segment on Sodom and Gomorrah, and they showed a pillar of salt, which was suggested that it was Lot's wife. Of course, Giorgio Tertullio said that was something built by aliens. I meant
styled by aliens.
He could pick up a rock and say aliens. You know, I'm just saying everything he says or looks at, everything he finds is an alien something. But anyway, by the way, I told people I'm gonna get one of those little pins he wears. I know you've been over there. Have you seen that pillar?
Have not seen the pillar. But like I said, it didn't dawn on me until later as we were trying to figure out how this would have worked because they've also found that salt, by the way, on the at the dig site. And again, bear in mind that hill on which Sodom sat at the north end of the Dead Sea is 75 to 150 feet above the plain. So whatever this was, and it's 6 miles away from the north end of the Dead Sea. So this wave that swept across the plain there, 75 to 100 feet high before it splashed up on that hill, again, if Lot's wife had stopped and turned around and tried to go back to the city, which she might have done, you could see why they would say, okay, yeah, she was turned into a pillar of salt, because basically this superheated salt water covered everything and prevented any crops from growing. And this was a really fertile plain. I mean, that was a really well-watered plain. They got year-round springs that come down from the hill that Sodom was built on. In fact, they've got now the country of Jordan has got a dam on one of those springs to provide water for the area there. Jordan is one of the driest countries on the planet. But the city there on that hill was continuously occupied from about 4,000 BC until it was destroyed around 1750 BC because they always had a water supply there. And then it went down to the plain. You had the people down there farming until this hit. And then it wasn't until about the time of David and Solomon that they were able to start growing crops again.
in your book, in chapter 5, you talk about sacrifices to the dead. Mm-hmm. Do you think that our political establishment anywhere does that sort of, any sort of sacrifices to maintain power?
Well, there's nothing I could prove, but I would not doubt it, because this is a thing that goes back a long, long way in history. And I saw in the chat room a question about the sacrifice of children to the dead. And I would say, yes, that is something that we found and documented in veneration, that the child sacrifice was a thing in the ancient world. There are Amorite buildings found with children that were buried beneath the walls. We find that even older in some of the buildings in the ancient Near East. But that continued into the Christian era, where, in fact, I'm going to write about that more in a forthcoming book that deals with Kronos, Saturn, who is identified with this old god, this group of angels that was punished by being sent down to Tartarus, you know, the Watchers from Genesis 6, in other words. I'm going to argue that Kronos, Saturn, was one of those Watchers. But you remember the Greek myth that Kronos was told in a prophecy that his children would rise up to, that a son would rise up to unthrone him, that would take his crown. And so Kronos ate his children as they were born to keep them from rebelling against him. Mm-hmm. His wife, after the first six, finally caught on to the pattern. And when Zeus was born, she gave Kronos a rock instead. And then Zeus was raised in secret on the island of Crete. And when he grew to manhood, or to became fully grown, through some trickery, got Kronos to throw up his siblings. And then they rebelled against Kronos and the Titans, and they were cast down to Tartarus.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you.
Even the historians in the ancient world, Daniel, understood that the parallel between the story of Kronos and Saturn and the practice, who is identified as Baal-Hamon, Baal-Hamon of the Phoenicians. Mm-hmm. The Greeks and Romans knew very well that the Phoenicians sacrificed their children on a regular basis. But even the Greeks did it. We can document sacrifices to Kronos at various points in their history. So, this is a thing. And it goes back a long, long way.
When you look at those stories, and man, you certainly have done your research in them, are they just myths, or were there Minotaurs and centaurs and the cat heads on Egyptian men, and dog heads? Is there truth to those, or just myths?
Well, there's a kernel of truth behind this, and I think when you're dealing with spirit entities, you've got to look at it kind of the same way you have to analyze the accounts of contact from alien abductions and contact with aliens. I mean, there are people who report being abducted and carried out through the wall of the house and lifted up into the mothership and whatever. Mm-hmm. Did this happen in the physical realm? Maybe not. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, however. So if you're seeing something in the spirit, or something is being done to you in the spirit realm, or as Josh Peck explains it with his multiverse experience, if this is being done in additional dimensions that we humans don't normally perceive, it might appear as though something that nothing is happening, while in fact things are happening, just in realms that we can't see. Mm-hmm. So having said that, does that mean that we're going to find someday the remains of a bull-headed human? Maybe not. Mm-hmm. But as I wrote in The Last Clash of the Titans, there's a chapter in there that deals with this bull imagery that was all over ancient Mesopotamia, dealing with the cherubim, or the cherubim of the Bible, are in Ezekiel chapters 1 and 10, where he describes the creatures with the four faces. When you really dig down and analyze it, you realize that the face of the cherub, you know, it's not the cute little baby with wings that we see in the paintings from the Middle Ages.
Right.
These were big dudes. Like, they were like a sphinx, but with a bull's body and a human bearded head. Mm-hmm. Or it may be like a winged entity with a bull's face, or the face of an ox on it. Now, are we ever going to find the skeleton of one of those things? No, probably not. But they're spirit beings. So does it mean that when ancient Mesopotamians saw them, which is why they put those big winged bulls with the human heads outside the Assyrian king's palace at Nineveh, does it mean those things aren't real? Well, no. They are real. We just may not find the physical evidence of them. So, I do think that there's a reason that we see so much bull imagery connected to the gods of the ancient world. I mean, even the name Kronos, who was the king of the Titans, mm-hmm. we show in Last Clash of the Titans from peer-reviewed secular scholar, you know, peer-reviewed paper, that his name probably derives from the Semitic word that means horns, as in the horned one. Mm. Now, hey, is it coincidence that we've depicted Satan for hundreds and hundreds of years as this entity with these horns?
All right.
Probably not.
By the way, Derek, somebody said there was a great picture of Joe Biden on your book. But somehow he's had some work done. Somehow it seems like I got to thank the Catholic priest for coming up with reframing the cherub from a big fierce warrior to a little naked baby. I mean, it's a Catholic priest I get to thank for that, right?
Be honest with you, I don't know. It may just be the influence of the church on the artists working in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. Not sure, but
well,
it's pretty clear that these entities were guardians of the throne of God. We see this in Revelation with the four creatures around the throne in Revelation, 4 and 5. And you're not going to have chubby little babies with wings guarding the throne of God.
Mm-hmm. No. And the adrenochrome, the drinking of children's blood. I mean, this we live in a culture, Derek, as you're well aware of. I would even say like the New Jersey governor who said, hey, if you got a baby that's born, you could stand around it and decide if it's going to live like ancient druids did. I don't know.
Oh, if that was, okay. That was Northam of Virginia. Ralph Northam of Virginia.
That's Ralph, that governor there, Northam. But it's to say that people can stand around a table and decide. I just get this picture of ancient druids every time I think of that. So we have this rampant abortion culture out here. Is the demonic hordes, is that where they've gone? Is that where these ancient sort of kings you talk about, are they managing these people to come up with these things?
Well, I would say they're certainly doing the work of their masters. And I would argue that the fallen angels are really calling the shots. And I'm going to argue in the book about Saturn or Kronos that even in the abyss, because I believe he's down in the abyss at the moment. These would be the angels who sinned that Peter wrote about, 2 Peter 2, verse 4. You know, God did not spare the angels when they sinned, mm-hmm. but thrust them down to, in our English Bibles say hell, but the Greek word is Tartarou, which means Tartarus. Thrust them down to Tartarus. It's the only place in the Bible that word is used, which means it's significant. And certainly, Peter understood the difference between Hades and Tartarus. Hades was where the dead went. Tartarus was a special place reserved for supernatural threats to the divine order. And I believe that the watchers of Genesis 6, the angels who sinned, are to be, they're the titans of Greek mythology. And I think that somehow Kronos and his bunch are still affecting and influencing the world from the abyss, even though they're not free to roam about and interact with us like they would like. I believe that demons are working on their behalf and doing their bidding.
Mm-hmm. So there's sort of a hierarchy, but in this book, Veneration, the demonic kings, are they at the top of the chain? Are they directly underneath Lucifer? Where are they in this hierarchy?
They would be underneath Lucifer. Interestingly enough, those Ugaritic or those Amorite texts from the ancient kingdom of Ugarit call these Rephaim spirits the warriors of Baal. Or for you scholars out there, just so you know, I know how to say it. It's Baal. There's a glottal stop in there. But Jesus in the New Testament, in the book of Matthew and then in Revelation 2, and I forget the chapter in Matthew, so I'm not going to say it wrong. When he's accused by Pharisees of casting out demons by the power of Beelzebul, which means Baal the prince, mm-hmm. Jesus responds and say, how can Satan fight against himself? How will his kingdom stand? So he identifies Baal as Satan. And we kind of see that in Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah 14, which is that famous chapter, how thou art fallen, Lucifer, mm-hmm. son of the morning. It describes what he wants. His goal is, the five I wills. But the point is that he wants to establish his throne on his mount of assembly. And then there's a phrase in there that says the sides of the north or the heights of the north. The Hebrew phrase there is Yarkate Tzafon. And that phrase only appears in the Bible three times. One is there. One is in Psalm 48, which is a contrast between Mount Zion, God's Mount of Assembly, mm-hmm. and this Tzaphon, which is Lucifer's Mount of Assembly. And then in Ezekiel 38 and 39, because remember when it says Gog of Magog mm-hmm. brings all of his armies from the uttermost parts of the north. Most prophecy scholars will look at that and say, okay, well, let's draw a line north from Jerusalem. Ah, must be Russia. No, Yarkatay Tzaphon is a cosmic north. We're dealing with a supernatural enemy here. And that enemy's Mount of Assembly, his Mount of the Congregation, the place where he holds court over his divine council, is a place called Mount Tzaphon. We know where that is. Today it's called Jebel al-Akra. It's in Turkey. It's very close to ancient Antioch. And everyone in the ancient world knew that was where Baal had his palace, built his palace there. That's where Zeus, who was just a Greek name for Baal, fought the chaos monster Typhon. The Hurrians and the Hittites, their storm god called Teshub or Tarhunt, just another name for Baal, also had his Mount of Assembly there. So this place is really a cosmic north. It's not a compass point. And I argued that in Last Clash of the Titans, that when we're arguing over whether it's Erdogan or Putin, we're missing the point because we're dealing with a supernatural enemy. We know that his rally point is this spiritual location in Turkey that for 4,000 years has been known as the place where Lucifer, Baal, Satan has held court. His Mount of Assembly is there, and his minions will come from there. And again, these Rephaim spirits are called the warriors of Baal. And that's why I argued in Last Clash of the Titans that I think what we're going to see in the end times is a demonic army led by Gog of Magog, or the Antichrist, who's essentially Satan's commander-in-chief, mm-hmm. bringing this demonic horde against Israel to try to take God's mm-hmm. Mount of Assembly, which is Zion, the Temple mm-hmm. Mount.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting chapter in your book, Veneration, it says Return of the Dead, Warriors of the Dead, Valleys of Travelers. But then earlier in chapter 20, you talk about planets. So a lot of dead things going on in your book there.
But we bring the UFO phenomenon into it.
But you got this one I want to key in, planets of the dead.
Yeah.
What is going on with that?
Well, you know, again, it's about the reports of contact that experiences or contactees in the UFO community claim that they hear or claim that they have. And I have no doubt that they're actually hearing from something. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's any solid evidence that these entities that are contacting these people are actually from, you know, Zeta Reticuli or wherever. It's not mm-hmm. really the Ashtar Command. It's really these entities that have been crossing over and interacting with us ever since the garden. Isn't it strange? I mean, and this is, I would just love to see a little more critical thinking in the UFO community. Why is it that contactees are hearing from these entities that are supposedly that have crossed the galaxy? Mm-hmm. And yet while they're so technologically advanced that they can cross the galaxy, but they can't figure out how to tap into a webcam. I mean, why is all of this communication telepathic or yeah. spiritual? Mm. And why do the messages contradict one another? Mm. I mean, if you look at that's where we brought this in here. So look, we're not saying that the UFO phenomenon is a hoax or that we make a distinction between the UFO phenomenon and the contactee abductee phenomenon. Because the UFO phenomenon, yeah, there are lights in the sky and you can oftentimes come up with a natural explanation. That's a secret craft the government's working on that they don't want us to know about, or it's swamp gas, or it's the planet Venus, or whatever. On some occasions, it really is something that we can't explain, like the tic-tac that the Navy pilots saw back in 2004, the USS Nimitz incident. Mm-hmm. But the contactee-abductee phenomenon is something else again. That is a spiritual phenomenon, not a physical phenomenon. And if it's spiritual and if it's not coming from Zeta Reticulans, then who is it? We argue that it is demonic, that the message that they bring and the nature of the contact, which often is, well, downright evil. I mean, what else can you call people who are being removed from their home, terrified, and in some cases experimented on in very invasive ways? There is no good way to characterize that as good. So that's why we brought that into the book, just to say, you know, there's a lot more going on here when we're looking at these spirits of the ancient giants, the Nephilim, who were the origin of the demons. If the UFO contactee phenomenon is demonic, well, hey, this goes all the way back to Genesis chapter 6.
Wow. I was attacked by some Mormons one time. And they said that I needed to join them. And I said, why? They said, well, we need subjects. I said, no, this is true. And I said, well, we mean subjects. Subjects where? And they go, on the planets, we're each getting assigned a planet, and we're going to rule over that planet. And we need subjects. I said, well, how many are they? He said, well, 144,000 planets. I said, okay. I said, so you want me to be your subject? And I said, not only no, but hell no.
Yeah.
Mark, I don't know. I don't know what you're on or what they're teaching you over there, but I'm not going to be nobody's subject. I'm no planet.
Well, you know, that was something that Josh Peck and I brought into the book, The Day the Earth Stands Still, which, of course, a play in that old movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. But we talked, or we wrote a bit about Mormon theology and how this modern UFO phenomenon actually has, you know, ancestors in theology that go back a long, long ways. So, it was, you can go all the way back to the ancient Greek philosophers theorized that maybe there's, life up there and those little stars up there. But really, when we start getting into the Enlightenment period, guys like Emanuel Swedenborg and Joseph Smith. You started getting into some high weirdness there as far as their theology went. And this idea that Jesus is a created being and that all of us can become gods ourselves with ruling our own planets. Mm-hmm. With all due respect to Mormons, who are very nice people, they're not worshiping the Jesus of the Bible. So,
well, I'll tell you what. See, that's why I'm not going to vote for Mitt Romney, man, because I'm not going to be a subject in that guy's planet.
You know, I actually got asked that question back in 2006, which was the lead up to the presidential election in 2008. I was doing a daily secular talk show in Columbia, Missouri, and I was asked, does Mitt Romney worship the same God you do? And I stopped, and I had to think about that for a second. It's like, okay, I know there are a lot of Mormons here in the area, but do I want to answer to the general manager of the station who'll get upset if I answer honestly, or no, I think I'm going to answer to a higher authority? So I spoke truly. I said, look, if Mitt Romney is following the official doctrines of the Church of Latter-day Saints, then no. And suddenly the phone lines just exploded.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. May 777 says, Derek, are there archangels present, and is St. Michael protecting people?
Well, I would say there are archangels, and we know that Michael is one of the two angels who's identified in Scripture, Gabriel being the other. We know that Michael, when he stands up in the book of Revelation, the street fight with Lucifer and his angels, Satan and his angels, is on. I heard an evangelist preach on this once, and it was great the way he did it. He said, look, we're all going to be caught up, and we'll be up there at the marriage supper of the Lamb, and there's going to be a street fight going on in the parking lot right outside for Michael and the rest of his guard take on Satan and their angels. So is Michael protecting us specifically? That I don't know. We don't have any scriptural indication for that. We do see a verse in the Bible that says that children should be cared for and taken care of because their angels are constantly petitioning for them in heaven. Mm-hmm. So there is a biblical basis for the idea of guardian angels, but don't know whether Michael is one of those who's got specific care for any specific person.
This is not on topic. This is from me and my own personal question. Your dog Sam passed away.
Yeah.
Sam the Dachshund. Love him. I think I don't know. He may have made an appearance on this show one time when you guys were on. I don't know.
He may have barked in the background, or at least one of us had to get up and let him outside. That's probable. Yeah.
But
that's why I stopped doing live shows.
Well, I love it. You don't know how many animals we've had in the background. I love it. I try to get them in the interview, man, or somebody's kids or somebody's wife is walking in the background. I say, hey, man, because this is a wild and crazy show, man. We haven't, you know, like I say, there's no line that we won't cross and no thing we won't do. But I was listening to you talk about it, and you know, I've read the Bible several times, and all of my time, I have never heard somebody say the scripture that shows that animals go to heaven. Could you look that up and read that just for people? Because sure. That question comes up all the time. Do animals go to heaven? And I think you nailed it with that scripture.
Well, you know, credit due to Tom Horn. Several years ago, he published a book with Terry James and a few others who contributed to it called Do Our Pets Go to Heaven?
Mm-hmm.
And this is before Skywatch TV, so this would be back around 2014, I think. And it was something that we, obviously all of us have had to deal with. All of us have had a pet that's gone on. And in Sam's case, and I just want to publicly thank all those people who were praying for Sam, because 2 weekends ago, Daniel, we thought he was going to be gone. He was really struggling and failing. We thought he was just very lethargic, didn't want to get out of bed, didn't want to eat, didn't want to drink. And then on Monday, a week ago Monday, he rallied and he was, eating, and he had more energy, and he was moving around again, and things looked good. So we had to go out of town for a couple of days, and he stayed with the lady who watches him while we're away. And she said that he was great, enjoyed going outside. She's got some rescue dogs there and kept him, and said that he seemed like his old self again. And then this past Monday morning, he just began to fail again after a great weekend here at home. Great weather. We were outside, took a couple of walks around the property. And just Monday, he once again just was very lethargic. And as the day went on, just lost more and more energy. Mm-hmm. He never seemed to be in any pain, which was truly a blessing. Mm-hmm. About 6:45 Tuesday morning. Interestingly, and let me lead up to it this way. Sharon had gone to bed, as she normally does, pretty early, and I stayed with Sam, and not only was he not keeping any food down, he began passing blood. Even with that, he didn't appear to be in any pain. But there were times when he would just get out of his bed and he would stare across the room, not at me, but just at some point in space.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would kind of go back to bed and lie down again. Then about 10:15, he got to the point where he wasn't really strong enough to get out of bed at all anymore. I woke Sharon up, and finally I went to bed, had to get up for work the next day, but she stayed up with him all night, and she's noticed that while she was holding him, there would be times when he would look up and, you know, look at something, but he wasn't just staring. He would, you know, track as though something, he was watching something moving.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd lay his head back down again. And she said this happened about 2-3 dozen times until she finally realized, wait a minute, maybe he's seeing something I can't see. And so she recited Psalm 91, which is a psalm of, you know, protection. And as she did that, he slipped into a coma at that point. So she came and woke me up. And about 30 minutes into it, you know, as he was lying there, and we could just see he would just periodically gasp, and mm-hmm. his body was shutting down. We decided to pray, you know, Lord, just make this passing easy. You know, just don't let him suffer. Just make his passing easy.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were praying with our hands on him, he took his last breath. So remarkable. If you were going to write a way to go, you know, and say, you know, if I could submit a request, Lord, here's how I would like to go, you know, at home in bed after a very short, relatively short illness. I mean, like one day, surrounded by the people who love you, you know, that's would be the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But back to your question, in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, Solomon wrote this, and I'm reading from the English Standard Version. For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. Now, on the surface, that sounds like Solomon, you know, being kind of depressed. You know, we're no better than the beast. We all die. We all turn to dust. But the key is that the word translated breath in Hebrew is ruach, which means spirit. And when you look up the usage of that word ruach in scripture, you see that that is, in fact, how it's used in many places in the scripture. So we're not trying to invent something here that doesn't mean right. what we want it to mean. It's something that points to a deeper meaning to that word than you see in the English. And again, the Septuagint translation, and I'll say again that the Septuagint translators, the Jewish scholars who translated the Bible into Greek 200 to 300 years before Jesus, will often have a better understanding of what the older Hebrew Then the Masoretic text, which is what our English Bibles are based on. The Masoretic text wasn't completed until between 700 and 900 AD, so almost 1,000 years after the Septuagint. And the Septuagint translates the verse this way, Ecclesiastes 3:19, "And also for them is there not the fate of the sons of men and the fate of the livestock, the fate of the beasts. It is one fate for them, as is the death of this one, so is the death of that one. And there is one spirit for all." So again, they all have the same breath. No, they all have the same spirit. So what we're seeing is that Solomon, under the influence of the Holy Spirit, writing that, animals and humans, animals have a spirit just like humans do.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then, add to that just this observation. This is something that we often don't think about because we're often reading the Bible alone, not studying it, or we're taking a lot of it as symbolic language or metaphoric. But one of our local police chiefs here has become a friend, said, "You know what occurred to me the other day?" "No." "So, well, we got horses in heaven, so why not dogs?" It's like, "Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, you're right. What is Jesus riding when he comes back in Revelation?" "He's riding a horse." Uh-huh. So he's riding a horse when he comes back, and we've got biblical support. Horses in heaven. So why not dogs, cats, birds, guinea pigs, hamsters, and so on? They all have the same ruach, and man has no advantage over the beasts.
Wow. That is amazing. That is good. I'm sure that's going to warm a lot of hearts out there because people have been asking that question for a long time. Whaley out of the live chat says, "Derek, what's the difference between the soul and the spirit?"
That's a good question. I really ought to have a good answer for that. Spirit is the part of us that continues on. I mean, I'm going to mangle this, so forgive me. There's a good difference, and I've got friends out there who've really made a study of this, and they're probably going to slap me around afterwards for mangling this. The soul, I think, and forgive me, because this is not something I've done some study on, but if I understand the explanation I've read correctly and had explained to me, because, I'm too busy diving into Canaanite cosmology to, really pay attention most of the time, is that the soul is like what you're thinking with, okay? When you're hearing thoughts in your head and, you're feeling, and that's basically your soul. Your spirit is the part of you that lives on after the body dies. Mm-hmm. So your soul is part of your spirit. But I may be wrong about that.
Well, no, that's the way I've always heard it, that it's your sort of your mind, will, and emotions, sort of the organic part that's running a sub-program in your body, but your spirit is something that resides in the place of your body, but is not in your body. It resides in the place. So those two can certainly coexist, and it makes sense that there is that, your mind, will, and motion.
Your soul is like your consciousness.
Yeah, in other right.
words, where your spirit is the actual, part of you that lives on.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting.
Really is eternal. Yeah.
An interesting kind of sub thing on that, Derek. This week, I think I read that some university has determined that your mind or your thoughts do not necessarily reside in your body, that they may be coming from somewhere else. And I've always kind of thought that something weird about that. I don't know that, it's like when you dream and you see things in your dream that you've never seen before. There's no basis to recall it. It's almost as if it was put in there. And, where did that come from? I don't know. That may be a time for another show. But let's talk about...
There have been some research done on people who are recipients of organ transplants and suddenly have different preferences, different tastes, and sometimes even different memories. So,
mm-hmm. Hey, now you're going to be at the next Branson conference.
Yeah, that's coming up in July. This is the True Legends Conference with Gen 6 Productions, Steve Quayle and his group putting this together. And the topic this year is really going to be fascinating. It's about ancient cataclysms and future catastrophes, or ancient catastrophes, something like that. I should know this because I keep talking about it. But July the 10th through the 12th at the Mansion Theater, mm-hmm. in Branson. Mm-hmm. And I will be talking about some research that Sharon and I are doing for a project later this year. In fact, we're going back to Israel for a few days in late April to get some video and meet with an archaeologist there who's done research at Gilgal Rephaim, which is that big, wheel of the giants there in the Golan Heights. But the research specifically is about the Rift Valley, the fault line that runs from the Red Sea all the way up to Turkey, and what it might be, what spiritual events have taken place along that rift, and whether perhaps we may have found a rebel in the Bible that even pre-existed Eden.
Wow. Wow. I love stuff like that. A quick question from me, or our final question too, from Peter from Australia. It says, have you ever been in contact with Frank Lord? He used to host Salvation Radio years ago and stopped hosting all of a sudden.
No, I'm afraid not.
And by the way, you and Sharon have been on the internet, and I actually listed you guys as the first couple of the internet, because you guys have been on the internet for so long. But when?
Because we're old.
All right. So when was your first PID broadcast?
March of 2005.
Wow. Yeah. And now here you are on Skywatch TV, going around the world, writing books. Wow. What a life story you got going.
Well, again, God's got a sense of humor. But I guess if you're faithful to what he's got in front of you, you know, things will happen. You know, I never envisioned this. I mean, I thought, okay, well, if we can keep doing this on evenings and weekends while I'm, you know, making a career as a salesman, okay, that's fine. But then God threw Tom Horn, and we owe Tom Horn a huge debt for, you know, inviting us to partner up with Skywatch TV. That has really opened the door. But Tom has been doing that and collecting a real group of talent here. I mean, you've got Josh Peck, who has come down here, and Christina Peck, who both are working on some really interesting projects. Josh has some stuff coming later this year that's going to be just mind-blowing. Keith Siana, who's now part of our team, who's doing some great video work behind the scenes. He's got more stuff coming up later this you know, that he will be part of as we continue to grow. But, you know, through Tom, Justin and Wes Fall, you know, moved from Atlanta to out here in the Ozarks and are producing some dynamite documentary films. So there's a gathering taking place here in the Ozarks, and Daniel just say, you know, hey, land here's cheap, and there's plenty of it. So,
well, I've been there plenty of times, man. We take our trailer down there, right in the middle of Branson. Maybe we could be a permanent resident down there.
There you go.
So that's awesome stuff. So, all right. So we got your actually have that offer that I saw on Skywatch TV for Veneration, and so people can go to Skywatch TV, or they go to your website, can't they?
Yeah, SkywatchTVStore.com would be the place to get the Veneration offer. We've got two deals, one that includes, as you see there, the book, Sharon's most recent novel, Realms of the Dead. And again, research that we've been doing for these books go into her fiction, plus the documentary film that we produced from our Israel tour last year, which actually will give people a hint at the secret project that's coming later this year, because we kind of allude to it there and show you some drone footage from our friend Aaron Lipkin of what we're talking about. And another great book from about 100 years ago from a scholar of the Bible who wrote about the concept of the underworld and what the pagan nations around ancient Israel believed. And he was really good, considering he didn't have access to any of these texts that went into our book, Veneration. So you get those three books plus the two-hour documentary, which includes 4 hours of additional teachings from me, Carl Gallups, and Rabbi Zev Porat for $35. But if you want Sharon's entire fiction series, you get those books there, plus the other five previous novels in her series for $100. And we've donated all of Sharon's novels to Skywatch TV, so that anything that gets sold through the store, all of those proceeds for her novels go to finance what's going on at Whispering Ponies Ranch.
Oh, awesome, awesome, awesome. Well, Derek, I'd love to have you on the program tonight. Can we have you on again sometime?
Anytime, brother.
All right, man. Appreciate you coming on. Stay safe, and we'll have you back.
All right, and Sharon sends her regards, and hopefully next time the migraine will not be a problem. But she said to say hello, and sorry she couldn't make it.
Hey, that's okay. All of our prayers are with you guys.
Appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye.
Likewise, bye-bye.
All right, everybody.